The U.S. Supreme Court recently handed down decisions on cases that will affect many areas of life. This hour, we'll hear about the cases, the impact of the decisions, and why the High Court ruled the way it did. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Same-sex couples are now recognized by the federal government. Pleading the Fifth just got a lot harder. Our DNA is a lot less private, and the heart of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is struck down. This hour, we'll discuss these and other decisions with Todd Pettis and Emily Hughes of the University of Iowa College of Law. Which decision did you celebrate or lament? Join our conversation after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And this hour, in the latest term, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down decisions on cases that will affect many areas of life, a very interesting term in the Supreme Court. This hour, we'll hear about some of the cases, the impact of those decisions, why the court ruled the way it did, and what it means for us here in Iowa. We'd like to have you join our conversation just to give you a brief overview of the cases we'll be looking at. Of course, the two same-sex marriage cases that were before the court. We'll be talking about those in the first half hour. Also, some civil cases pleading the Fifth just, or actually some criminal cases pleading the Fifth just got harder. DNA that we have in all of our bodies, a lot less private, according to a ruling. And the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the very heart of it struck down. I want to hear from you. What decision did you celebrate or lament this term of the U.S. Supreme Court? We'd like to have you weigh in on that. 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Also, because Supreme Court cases tend to be complicated and have ramifications going out to the left, to the right, to backward, forward, perhaps you have a question about the ramifications of some of these decisions, and you can put it to our guests. Joining us in the studio today, Todd Pettis is Associate Dean for Faculty at the University of Iowa College of Law and the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation. Todd Pettis has been with us before. Welcome back, Todd.
Thanks for the invitation.
And joining us for the first time, Emily Hughes, Professor and Bauma Fellow in Law at the University of Iowa College of Law. You specialize in criminal defense. Emily Hughes, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm going to ask you, Emily, to sit back, and because we're going to be talking about some of the civil cases before the High Court to start off, the two cases that dealt with same-sex marriage. Todd Pettis, Windsor v. United States, the so-called DOMA case. Can you give us an overview of what that was actually about and what it called into question?
Sure. Very quickly, the Defense of Marriage Act, which became law in 1996, has two important parts, and only one of them was at issue before the court this last term. The part that was not at issue, Section 2 of the statute, it says that one state that opposes same-sex marriage does not have to honor same-sex marriages that are performed in other states. The constitutionality of that part of the statute was not in front of the court. The part that was in front of the court was the part that said, anytime you see federal law make reference to spouse or to marriage, that is referring only to heterosexual marriages. And there are reportedly about well over 1,000, maybe over 1,100 statutes that do make reference to marriage and spouse. And so very broadly important ruling with respect to how the federal government is going to handle marriage.
Mm-hmm. So, right. Go ahead.
Yeah. And so the court held, as those who follow the news know, the court held that that part of the statute is unconstitutional. And so the law as it stands today is that if you're a same-sex couple and you have been lawfully married in a state like Iowa that recognizes same-sex marriage, the federal government will honor that marriage as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, some confusion may arise here. Since DOMA, Defense of Marriage Act, was ruled unconstitutional, that doesn't, though, mean that same-sex marriage is legal nationwide.
No, that's emphatically right. The court did not say that you have a nationwide constitutional right to same-sex marriage. And so today, and a majority of the states still ban same-sex marriage. They may continue to ban same-sex marriage, at least based on what we've heard from the court thus far.
Okay, 1-866-780-9100, talking about U.S. Supreme Court decisions handed down in the past few weeks. Which decision did you celebrate? Which did you lament? 1-866-780-9100. River-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. Caller from Cedar Falls wants to weigh in. Lauren, hi to you.
Hello. Good afternoon. How are you?
I am doing well. How are you today?
I'm very good, thank you.
What interests you about the Supreme Court's decisions this term?
Well, I was celebrating with my new wife the Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriage. We were just married last Saturday, and so we were very excited that we can now file as a married couple for federal taxes. But it's kind of a bittersweet victory because, like was just stated, you know, we can cross the border from Iowa into another state and our marriage suddenly kind of disappears, which is a kind of magical thing that happens to same-sex couples. And I actually had a question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, we're legally married in Iowa, but if we move to a state that does not have legalized same-sex marriage, are we still able to file as a married couple at the federal level, even if we're living in a state that doesn't have same-sex marriage legalized, since we were legally married in a state that does?
Todd Pettis.
That's a terrific question, and the Obama administration is currently pondering how to answer it and whether it has the authority to provide an answer on its own without getting Congress involved. And so just a state kind of at a level of generality, the question you've just asked, it comes up in lots of different settings. There are many federal laws when they refer to marriage that say if you are lawfully married in the state where you currently reside, then you have the following rights and privileges and so forth. And so as you've just used your own case as an example, you're lawfully married in Iowa, but, you know, you move south to Kansas or Nebraska, you're not lawfully married there. And there
right.
are many federal laws that say, well, we're going to look or at least prior to this Windsor decision, it was quite easy to figure out what the right answer is. We say, well, you're not lawfully married under the law of the state where you currently reside. And so your marriage is not portable. And the Obama administration has directed its cabinet officials and the IRS, the Department of Labor and others to take a look at all of the regulations that fall under their jurisdictions and see what they should do. Should they say that it's and the choice really here, we call it the place of the state of celebration where you are married, or the state of domicile where you currently live. The Obama administration, having been opposed to this DOMA provision and favoring quite explicitly same-sex marriage, presumably the Obama administration is going to do as much as it feels it can to recognize the portability of your marriage. But we're just going to have to wait to see. In the meantime, I would say for all listeners who are thinking about this decision, it's a good time to find a local tax attorney, someone who knows the ins and outs of tax law, because the answers to these questions might turn out to be kind of complex.
Lauren from Cedar Falls, thank you. We dove right into the content of your question and the implications, and neglected to say congratulations and wishing you and your wife a happy life together.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling from Cedar Falls. 1-866-780-9100. Bringing up the tax question that Lauren did in there in Cedar Falls, the IRS allows tax returns to be amended for the current year and three previous years. Now, can, for instance, same-sex couples married in Iowa amend their tax returns, their federal tax returns, based on this decision?
Tax attorneys, as I understand it, are advising their clients right now to go ahead and file amended returns and see how the Obama administration handles them. But you're exactly right. If you think, you know, set same-sex marriage aside, just as a matter of general federal tax law, if you think that some mistake was made on a prior year's tax return, you've got 2 or 3 years to go back and file an amended return. And so people who are still in that window, who for example, last year a same-sex married couple thinks that it would have been to their benefit to file married jointly, but they were forced to file separately, if it's within the last 2 or 3 years, they probably will be able to refile and get back some money. That, too, is going to be part of the guidance that we're expecting from the IRS sometime in the in the near future.
Todd Pettis is with us, dissecting, giving us analysis on the latest U.S. Supreme Court decisions. We're going through a number of them this hour. Todd specializes in civil litigation. Emily Hughes of the University of Iowa College of Law is standing by to give us some insight on some criminal cases before the courts. Let's talk about the case of Hollingsworth v. Perry, otherwise better known as California's Prop 8 case. That was a case where California had a referendum banning same-sex marriage.
Yeah, and of the two cases, if there was going to be a case this term where the court would say something broadly sweeping about same-sex marriage, such as, for example, that same-sex couples across the country have a constitutional right to marry, this was going to be that case. But it also became clear after oral arguments that a number of the justices had reservations about jumping too quickly toward any such grand pronouncements. And so what the court ultimately held by a 5-4 vote was that they really didn't have the power to speak. We call it – they held that they didn't have jurisdiction. Very quickly, the problem there was that the name of the case is Hollingsworth versus Perry. Hollingsworth is Dennis Hollingsworth. He is one of the chief proponents of Prop 8, the law in California that banned same-sex marriage. And when California officials refused to defend Prop 8 because they didn't like it and they favored same-sex marriage, Hollingsworth was allowed by the trial court to step in and defend the law on the state's behalf. And the Supreme Court ultimately held that in states that have citizen initiatives of this sort, those proponents don't have the legal authority to appear in court on behalf of the state to defend the law.
Interesting in this case, California's Prop 8 case, that the justices did not line up along ideological lines, did they?
No, not at all. In the DOMA case, they did. It was the four Democratic appointees with Justice Kennedy, and that's the five, and then the four well-known conservatives unhappy with the outcome. In Prop 8, it was different. Chief Justice Roberts wrote the majority opinion, and Justice Scalia joined, but so did Justices Breyer and Kagan and Ginsburg. On the other side, dissenting in that case was Justice Kennedy, who wrote the majority opinion in DOMA, and he was joined by Justices Thomas and Alito and Sotomayor. So
the explanation, I mean, does this mean that the high court is not as ideologically bound as we are led to believe?
Yeah, ideology clearly matters. Sometimes votes are relatively predictable. For example, no one expects Justice Scalia or Thomas, for example, to suddenly come out in favor of a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. They've made it clear that they don't see it that way. But it's not inevitable. These are all very smart people trying their best to figure out what the law as they understand it requires in a given case. And sometimes even a very high-profile case such as that, we see the ideological boundaries really being quite meaningless.
Join our conversation as we survey the latest U.S. Supreme Court decisions this term, 1-866-780-9100. Craig is joining us in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Craig.
Hi. I have a concern. If other sexual orientations have as strong a lobby as the gay and lesbian community, like, multiple partners, polygamy, mm-hmm. Will they be able to have equal protection under the law and, qualify for benefits? And what mm-hmm. if the gay or lesbian person wants multiple partners to marry, will they be able to qualify?
Good question. Thank you, Craig, because critics have argued that this opens the door to multiple spouses, to polygamous marriage. Todd Pettis, is there an illegal underpinning?
Yeah, it's a good question, and the best way to answer it is to kind of think through it as follows. Whenever you're claiming an individual right, a right to do something under the Constitution, the court first looks to see whether you have any grounds for making such a claim, and then they ask the government that's resisting that right, what are your reasons for resisting? And what we know from the DOMA decision, from the Windsor case, is when it comes to questions of marriage, if a government's refusal to recognize a certain kind of marriage is only based on kind of a moral condemnation and a desire to keep someone, as the court saw it in that case, as kind of a second class marriage or a demeaning marriage or a stigmatized marriage, if that's the only reason, then the government's reason is not good enough and the two people or perhaps more would be allowed to marry. So when we talk about things like polygamy, the key question is, why does the government not permit it? If the answer is, well, government just wants to stigmatize those who believe in polygamy, they just want to make it known that we just morally disapprove, then that's not going to be a good enough reason. But if there are other kinds of reasons, financial reasons, welfare of the children, health concerns, I don't know, any other categories of reasons, then the court would be asked to say, okay, let's take a look at those reasons and decide whether we think they're good enough under the Constitution.
Thank you, Craig, for that call from Cedar Rapids. California's Prop 8 case also has something to say about the future of ballot initiatives. Here we have a ballot initiative that went before the people of California that banned same-sex marriage and yet was not enforced, and now same-sex marriage is the law of that land, California.
Yeah,
and so what does that mean for the future of these types of direct democracy initiatives?
Well, they face a problem now, and the justices who dissented with Justice Kennedy leading them, this was exactly the problem they pointed to in their dissent. They said, let's just look at the logic here for a second. States like California that recognize citizen initiatives, why do they do it? Well, one of the reasons, one of the main reasons they do it is they want to give ordinary citizens, like most of our listeners and me, just give ordinary non-governmental people a chance to take the law into their own hands if their elected officials are not doing what they want. Okay, so that's what California does. And California has a very powerful initiative system. A lot of their law gets made that way. Well, then people who favored Prop 8 exercising their rights with respect to citizen initiatives, they got the law they wanted. And then the official government, the people officially in power said, we're not going to defend the law. And so Justice Kennedy says, well, so look at this. We have people who have rights for citizen initiatives, and the reason they do is they need to be able to have the ability to do an end run around elected officials. Now, if those elected officials won't themselves defend the law, you can't step in and defend it on their behalf. And so the law kind of goes down in flames with no one left to defend it. And so there's a question mark going forward for those states that do recognize initiatives. How are they going to handle this problem? And there are some legal possibilities, but they at this moment remain possibilities.
A lot of gray areas, a lot of questions open by these two decisions. We'll have to leave those behind for now, hopefully come to those in the future at a point. But we do want to move on to one of the other civil cases that was very significant, Shelby County v. Holder, otherwise known as the Voting Rights Act case. Before we have to take a break in about 5 minutes, Todd Pettis, tell us what was that about and how did the court rule?
Well, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 set up something that was called a pre-clearance procedure. And using a few different measures, such as voter registration rates and voter turnout rates, Congress in the 1960s identified some states that had real problems with racial discrimination in voting. And if, for example, if their voter turnout rate was lower than 50%, Congress said, well, the reason for that probably is that your substantial minority population is being prevented somehow from registering to vote or from actually turning out on election day. And so those jurisdictions that fell within this, we call it a coverage formula, had to get preclearance. And what that means is if they want to make any change in their election laws of any kind, for example, they want to start requiring voter ID, or they want to change the voting district lines, or they want to change the machinery that's used to cast ballots, or they want to change the location of polling places, they had to go to the federal government for permission so that the federal government could take a close look and see, are you just using this as some kind of sneaky way to discriminate based on race? And what the court held in a case called Shelby County at the end of the term was that coverage formula is unconstitutional because as of today, here we are in 2013, Congress had never changed the coverage formula. It was still relying on data from the 1960s and the early 1970s. And the court said, if you want to try to subject a state to this preclearance arrangement, you've got to do so based on data that exists today.
Mm-hmm. In the dissent, Justice Ginsburg wrote that getting rid of this preclearance clause of the Voting Rights Act was like, and this is her quote, throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you are not getting wet.
Yeah, and her argument was one of the reasons why conditions have improved in these jurisdictions that have to go through preclearance. One of the reasons why when we look at them now, we don't really see any differences between voter registration rates. And in fact, in a lot of these states, African-American turnout is now heavier than for the whites. She says that's because we have this preclearance procedure in place. And if we get rid of it, racial discrimination is going to return.
Mm-hmm. So can we expect in these states, what, nine states, that Republican candidates, for instance, will have a better chance?
I don't know which – I wouldn't want to say which party it's going to favor. Probably depends a lot on local politics. I'm sure that's often going to be the case.
That's speculated, yeah.
It's speculated. An even more immediate question right now is Congress going to make any attempt at all to come up with a new coverage formula? That is to say, are they going to make any attempt at all to try to come up with a new way of identifying those states where racial discrimination in voting remains a particular problem to such an extent that that state should be forced to get the federal government's permission to make any changes in its election laws? I'm very skeptical politically, even though politics isn't my area. And from a legal point of view, whatever coverage formula Congress might come up with, it's going to get a very close look from the court, and odds are it's not going to stand up.
Let's go back to our phones, 1-866-780-9100. Which decision did you celebrate or lament from the U.S. Supreme Court in recent weeks? Let's go to Julie in Ames. Hi, Julie.
Hi. I just have a quick question as a follow-up from someone who called earlier about the polygamy issue.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, that's not legal in any states. Are there examples of marriages that are recognized as legal in one state and not another?
I can't name which states, but I believe marrying your first cousin is an example. And I'm not a family law, marriage law expert, but I believe marrying your first cousin is permitted in some jurisdictions, not in others.
And so that would affect federal law as well as this?
Well, with respect to the recent Supreme Court rulings, you mean?
Yeah. I mean, if you married your first cousin in one state, moved to another state, would that make a difference?
No. What the court has said is that the federal government cannot rely on heterosexuality or homosexuality as a basis for deciding what counts as a valid marriage. It hasn't extended beyond that. The Supreme Court did not say you have a constitutional right to marry whomever you want. What it says is that the federal government cannot rely on sexual orientation to decide whether a marriage is valid.
Julie, thank you for calling from Ames. Very quickly, before we have to take a break, can you tell us, Todd Pettis, neither the cases, the DOMA or the Prop 8 cases, were there was not a violation of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. Quickly, tell us the significance of that.
Well, what we know so far is, if I'm following the flow of your question, Ben, is that states still can decide if they wish that they don't want to recognize same-sex marriage.
Okay. So that perhaps that this court could have decided that in one of these cases but didn't go for that.
The court could have said in the California case that you have a 14th Amendment right to marry a person of the opposite sex. The court did not say that. Instead, they said we don't have the power to speak in this case.
And that would have been certainly a broader, more far-reaching win for proponents of same-sex marriage.
Oh, absolutely. There's only about a dozen states right now in the country that honor same-sex marriage, and the answer to that question would have changed. We would have said all states now, you have a right to same-sex marriage, and that's not yet the case.
Todd Pettis with us. He's with us. He's on the faculty of the University of Iowa College of Law. Also, Emily Hughes is with us. She will be back in our second half hour, as well as Todd. And we're going to be talking about a couple of criminal cases that were decided before the U.S. Supreme Court. When we come back, pleading the fifth was put before the court. Also, your DNA, it's a lot less private than we thought. We'll hear about those cases when we come back. We hope you'll join our conversation. What decision did you celebrate or lament? What questions do you have about the decisions that were handed down? So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, given the massive protests flaring once again in Egypt, we'll talk about the political situation there with our analysts. Also with longtime Iowa resident Dr. Hani El-Khadi. He is a native of Egypt and has just returned from 2 weeks in Cairo and other areas of Egypt. And we'll hear from him tomorrow. Also, the EU uproar over Edward Snowden's revelations about American spying. And here at home, what will happen with immigration reform in the U.S. House now that that bill has passed the Senate. Politics Day tomorrow. We hope you'll join us here on River to River. Today, we're talking about Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court decisions handed down within the last few weeks. In the first half of our program, we talked about those two cases, headline cases dealing with same-sex couples. Those are civil cases. Also, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, a key part of that struck down. This half hour, we want to focus more on some criminal cases, decisions of those handed down this term. Joining us, Todd Pettis. You heard him in the first hour. He specializes in civil litigation on the faculty of the University of Iowa College of Law. Emily Hughes is with us. She specializes in criminal offense at the University of Iowa College of Law. So let's start with you, Emily. Let's talk about this case that concerns DNA and how it's a bit less private than we thought. This is a case called Maryland v. King. What is it about?
Maryland v. King is about a defendant, Alonzo King, who was arrested for basically menacing some people with a gun, first and second degree assault charges. And when he's brought into the station to be booked for the assault charges, they take a DNA sample. So basically what that means is with a Q-tip, the Q-tip inside his mouth and his cheek, and they get some DNA. About 3 months later, they run that DNA, and the DNA turns up to be a hit with a cold case, which is an unsolved rape, and then he's charged for the unsolved rape. So the question in the case, it's a Fourth Amendment issue, was that search inside his mouth, getting that DNA sample, was that okay under the Constitution?
And some of the arguments here, that one of the key arguments is how much is that swab in your mouth, that Q-tip in your mouth, like taking your fingerprint. So flesh that out a little bit.
Exactly. So at oral argument and in the court's opinion, you hear a lot of discussion about whether taking a DNA sample is like taking fingerprints. Is it like taking a booking photo, or is it like searching your house? And so the court sides with the idea that it's a routine booking procedure, that it's more like taking fingerprints and taking a photograph than it is like going and searching somebody's house.
And it doesn't matter that that DNA is taken and pertains to this one charge. It is then put into a database, and you can be checked against all DNA found at crime scenes anywhere.
That's exactly right. And in fact, all 50 states allow for convicted felons to have their DNA taken. And so what was different about this case was this had to do when someone was arrested and the DNA being run before any conviction. So it's during the time before somebody's actually been found guilty of the case that they're arrested for. And then the DNA was actually matched to a cold case, not a case that was the case that they were arrested for.
Now, Justice Scalia voted against this. He was a dissenter in this opinion, allowing law enforcement to take DNA upon arrest. He wrote in his, I guess you would say, scathing dissent that he wrote that the court's decision, quote, taxes the credulity of the credulous. What's behind that comment?
He is absolutely a scathing dissent. He takes great issue with the court's characterization that this is all about identifying the person that they've arrested. So, for example, fingerprints, you run them through a fingerprint database and they match up to the fingerprints of the person when they were arrested last time. That it's a measure of a method of identifying someone. And Scalia says this is not at all about identifying somebody. It's only about solving unsolved cold cases. And so the justification that the majority uses, Scalia absolutely disagrees with, which is the majority is saying this is about identifying the individual, making sure, you know, we've got the right person in custody. It's about bail determinations. And Scalia says, no, 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 this is about solving cold cases.
Now, it was Justice Breyer, a typically liberal-leaning justice, who wrote the opinion here. Was that unusual?
You know, it wasn't so unusual. Justice Breyer and Justice Scalia flip-flop in ways that one wouldn't anticipate on Fourth Amendment cases. Scalia coming out where he did in this case in the dissent, and Breyer coming out in the majority. One of the reasons for that is Breyer really likes the balancing test that the court does in this case.
What does that mean, the balancing test?
It's balancing the government's interest in getting the DNA sample against the individual's interest in privacy and saying that the government's interest outweighs the individual's interest in privacy. And Scalia does not like that balancing test at all. He really wants to go back to the framers' intent in creating the Fourth Amendment and the idea that general warrants shouldn't issue. We should be really careful about the kinds of searches we do without warrants.
This is a good illustration, is it not, as one interpreting the Constitution as a living document, the other one wanting to go to the original intent. Is that often at the heart of some of these cases?
Very much so.
Mm-hmm. What does this ruling mean for us here in Iowa?
Well, it's really interesting because Iowa does not allow currently for DNA to be taken of arrestees in the way that the Maryland statute did. So in one way, there's no immediate implication for Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
That said, and Scalia points this out in dissent, now that this is on the books in terms of the Supreme Court saying this is okay, it may open the floodgates to a certain extent for statutes to get passed across the country, allowing for DNA to be taken of arrestees in these kinds of situations, which the court clarifies has to be serious offenses. But what serious offenses means is a whole other question.
Does this decision raise any other gray areas that you see?
Well, one area is the the arrestee versus the conviction, but another is the serious offense area, which is what qualifies as a serious offense. Iowa is unique in that our felonies, our class A, B, C, D felonies, they fall a little bit higher than some other states. So, for example, our aggravated misdemeanors, you can be sentenced to 2 years in prison in Iowa for an aggravated misdemeanor. And, the kinds of aggravated misdemeanors in Iowa that would qualify as serious offenses, it raises some interesting issues.
Emily Hughes is with us of the University of Iowa College of Law. Our legal expertise, along with Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law, we're surveying recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions and what they mean for us. If you'd like to join our conversation, perhaps you have a question about one of the decisions handed down by the High Court over the past couple of weeks, or perhaps you just have a question about the way the Supreme Court works. 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org, our email, tweet us at IPR Talk, or find us on Facebook and post a message on our Facebook page, our Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Let's talk about another criminal case that the U.S. Supreme Court recently decided, Salinas v. Texas. This has to do with we call it the Miranda rights, pleading the fifth. The fact that, your silence should not be interpreted in a certain way. What was this case specifically about?
That's right. This is a Fifth Amendment case. And in this case, there was a murder in a Houston house, and they just didn't know who did it. The clues that they had was that a witness had seen a dark-colored car speed away from the murder, but they really just didn't have any clues to go on. So during their investigation, the police determined that Salinas had been in the house the night before the murder, and so they sort of thought maybe he was a suspect. He happened to have a dark-colored car in his driveway, and so they asked him to come into the station to talk about it. They also asked him if they could take his shotgun and test it for ballistic purposes because they had found some shotgun shells in the house. He said they could test it. He went down to the station and talked to them, and he talked for about a little under an hour. And then they asked him, if we were to test the gun that you gave us against the shotgun shells, would there be a match? And at that point, he stopped talking and he was silent. He looked down at his shoes. He looked nervous. They say that the prosecutor said he looked kind of tense. He never answered that question. They asked him some other questions, and then he continued talking. Well, they released him. He went home. And then a couple days later, somebody said that he had confessed to the crime. So they went to try to go find him, but he had actually taken off, and it wasn't for years later that they actually found him and arrested him for this. When it finally went to trial, the whole issue in this case is that the prosecutor, during closing arguments, argued to the jury, basically, you know he's guilty because when we asked him, would your shotgun match the shells, he was silent. And what kind of innocent person wouldn't answer that question? An innocent person would say, what are you talking about? I didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole issue was, could the prosecutor comment on his silence?
And how did the case rule, the court rule?
And the court said that was fine for the prosecutor to comment on his silence.
Why?
And the reason, the court said, was because he had not specifically said at the time that he was being silent, I invoke my right not to answer. I invoke my Fifth Amendment rights. And by being silent, that wasn't enough to basically put his Fifth Amendment rights into action.
So the lesson for us, if we are accused of a crime, is what? What do you draw from this case that we should see as relevant if we ever get into such a position?
Well, so what you should say is, in terms of if you're going to kind of say the magic words, which was kind of – that was part of what was discussed during oral arguments – you know, something very clear, like, I want to invoke my Fifth Amendment rights here, would be the best that you could do.
Just saying I choose to remain silent is not good enough. You have to say Fifth Amendment rights, or
well,
something to that effect.
The court didn't specifically answer that question. The court, mm-hmm. And in fact, Breyer, it's interesting, Breyer is coming in on the dissent in this case, and he takes issue with that very question. As you know, there isn't there aren't any special words. It's not a ritualistic formula. And being silent in order to invoke your right to remain silent should be enough.
Okay. Let's move on to a couple of other questions that occurred to us as we talk about the Supreme Court and this term. Press attention, besides being given to the decisions, many of which we've reviewed here in the last hour, also being given to behavior in the courtroom. Chief among them, not Chief Justice, but chief among these behaviors, Justice Samuel Alito rolling his eyes, shaking his head, looking at the ceiling, as Justice Ginsburg reading a dissent from the bench, her dissent of the Voting Rights Act decision. Now, how much of a breach of court decorum is this, in your opinion? Maybe back to you, Todd, or either one of you. Go ahead. What is expected in the court? Stony faces? Poker faces?
Well, of course, there are no rules. If you go and sit and watch the justices, and a little footnote here, if you go to Washington, D.C., it's a fun thing to do. Members of the public frequently are allowed to file in, at least in the back of the room, and watch the justices in action for a short time. You know, some of them are difficult to read. Others are very demonstrative. Generally, let's set aside the eye roll for a second. They chat with one another kind of quietly, putting their hands over the microphone sometimes. Sometimes they slip notes to each other. So they're not it's not as if they're carved in stone. They're lively, three-dimensional people, and they have personalities, and those personalities often show themselves. I think here what kind of touched a nerve was, you know, Justice Ginsburg is the – now the senior member of the court in terms of age. She's the oldest member of the court. She's held – she's revered by some whose causes she has championed. She has had some serious health concerns. When you listen to her speak, her voice has gotten feeble over the years. And Justice Alito kind of leaned back and reportedly and rolled his eyes. So, you know, it's not – that I don't think that
YouTube video of this. No cameras.
So I don't think it's the eye rolling per se is thought to be forbidden. I think it's the combination of one of the newest members of the court showing perhaps in some people's judgment a lack of respect for someone whom other people have a great deal of respect for.
A lot of press given to this. Emily Hughes, do you think that it's overblown by the media?
Well, I do think that that the justices obviously disagree with each other quite often. And I think it's really interesting when you see it sort of taken out on paper. You know, I mean, like, look at Scalia's dissent in the Maryland versus King. He's outraged. And
that's what we should be paying attention to, right?
To a certain extent, I think it's perhaps more effective for the justices to put their frustration out in words rather than the other antics. But, you know, justices are human too, that's mm-hmm. for sure.
Something that Justice Alito regrets, do you imagine?
I don't know. He's not likely to publicly comment on it because then it sets a precedent that whenever there's criticism, you're going to go and issue a press release saying what you intended. Justice Alito, before people will remember during President Obama's State of the Union address, when President Obama criticized Citizens United, Justice Alito shook his head and mouthed, it appears from the video, mouth words, that's not true, or some words to that effect. But, you know, we're getting to know all these justices. We're getting to know Justice Alito. And this may be a feature of his personality. He's a younger member of the court. We're going to have lots of opportunity to get to know him better in the future.
Emily Hughes, you talked about really putting the spotlight on the written opinions here. In his DOMA dissent, Justice Scalia used the term arble garble. Can you tell us what arble garble is? I don't know. You or Todd? Anybody know what that is?
I don't know what arble garble is, but it's like Jabberwocky verse.
Somehow. It is what it sounds like.
It has kind of a curious meaning of its own, though you can't look it up in the dictionary. And Justice Scalia says arble garble. Somehow we all know what he means. It's, you know, kind of nonsense. But
how does that fit into his style of writing overall?
Well, you compare Justice – I think that the kind of the closest comparison right now on the court is Justice Scalia and Justice Kagan. And reportedly they went on a recent hunting trip together and are developing a good friendship. But they both write in a very kind of non-legalese, down-to-earth, kind of emotion-reflecting, plain-speaking kind of way. And it makes for – great reading, just as kind of from a literary point of view. It's very captivating. It's accessible to a broad range of people. And Justice Scalia often on the right, though not always. Justice Scalia and Justice Kagan often on the left, though not always. That's their style. Other justices are much more formal.
And sort of leaning towards academies, dare I say.
No, feel free to say it. That's right.
Okay. What about the fact that Justice Kagan is supposedly to have quoted Tommy Tutone in one of her opinions this term? Does anybody know about that little snippet from the press?
I don't have any further light to shed on it.
Nor do I.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the future of the court. President Obama, 3.5 years roughly left of his second term. On a lot of people's minds, how likely is it that he will appoint another Supreme Court justice?
Well, it's as likely as, you know, I mean, it takes a Supreme Court justice to step down for him to do it. And given Ginsburg is, as Todd mentioned earlier.
Yeah, Ginsburg has reached her 80s and she has had some health problems, though reportedly she's doing fine now. Justice Scalia is in his upper 70s. Justice Thomas is younger than that, though reportedly does not at all like living in Washington, D.C. It's not his favorite place to be. And when he gives interviews, and he does not always come off as the happiest person with his work, and he's quite candid about that. And so Justice Souter is a good example. You know, he's no longer on the court. He was by judge standards, he was a younger man and healthy and decided that he was ready to move on to other things. And so we'll see. A few years is a long time. Some people speculated that a while back that Justice Ginsburg would step down now. She hasn't done that. She's hired a team of recent law graduates we call clerks to help her for next year. And so it appears we're not going to have any retirements for next year. But as these justices reach these upper ages, the scrutiny or kind of the speculation among ordinary folks and the media is just going to get more intense about who's going to be next. And when the time comes that Justice Kennedy announces his retirement, you know, we should fasten our seatbelts because there's going to be a royal battle over who his replacement should be, since he's often the one who swings and determines the outcomes.
Okay, that would be the royal battle. So when you question or when we ask about someone's mental acuity, their fitness to be on the U.S. Supreme Court, and these are, if they wish, for life terms, who judges mental fitness? Is it only the justice in question who judges his or her own mental fitness and when to step down, as Souter did?
Yeah, and just to be clear, Justice Souter didn't step down, I don't think, because
thank you.
You're exactly right. It's up to that justice to decide if they're going to – now, if they're in a coma in the hospital, there's maybe some different set of proceedings. I'm not sure how we'd proceed. But they make their own decisions. Now, there have been times in history when a justice is or a judge on a lower federal court, they've appeared to be slipping, and some of their fellow judges and justices with whom they've become friends may make a special trip and say, you know, maybe the time has come. And those are different
conversations. But all informal. There is no formal mechanism.
No formal mechanism. No.
Of questioning a fellow justice's performance or mental faculties.
Yeah, and certainly, even though we have some aging justices at this point, there's no indication at all that anybody's mental faculties are slipping.
No, these people are in sharp, fine form. No one could read any of these opinions and say they're not what they once were.
Are these opinions penned from these justices or from clerks? In part,
it's a combination, and it varies from justice to justice. My speculation is that Justice Scalia doesn't.